so before the pieces of the vacuum chamber have begun to move, the field will wrap itself around the anomaly, maintaining the vacuum and preventing any external matter from perturbing the anomaly.
What about the metal casing? Isn't it going to fall right into the anomaly? And won't all that metal knock it around?
No, it won't be able to touch it. Think of the stasis field as a force field that is so powerful that it can repel anything away from the anomaly. Even an explosion couldn't penetrate it.
Sounds like the deflector shields on the starship Enterprise.
That's one way to think about it.
So, what is the second stasis field generator for?
Good question. Once the primary stasis field generator has captured the anomaly, scientists will activate the Rho Gateway device to create a wormhole into deep space. However, an opening into the vacuum of space would immediately depressurize the facility, sucking out the air and all of us with it. The secondary stasis field generator will form an invisible door sealing off the gateway device opening before the gateway is activated. Once the wormhole has formed, scientists will confirm the far-end coordinates to ensure it's not too close to Earth or within a star. Then, they will use the primary stasis field generator to move the anomaly to the gateway, modulating the two stasis fields to allow the first to pass through the second and release the anomaly into the wormhole.
And after that?
I would guess there's going to be a big party.
The camera shifted back to Ted's nervous smile. Let's all hope and pray that happens.
Approaching final countdown to anomaly capture.
The last 10 seconds of the countdown echoed through the cavern.
Initiating anomaly capture.
With a sound like thunder, the huge steel anomaly containment device came apart and crashed to the concrete floor. For several seconds, the only sound that could be heard was the reverberating echoes of its fall. Then the alarm sounded.
Warning! Primary stasis field generator power at 82% and falling. Stasis field degradation detected.
At the ATAC, a bearded Scandinavian technician ran toward one of the large electronic racks, his long blonde hair flowing out behind him as he leaped up onto the second level of equipment, ripped out a panel, rolled onto the floor, and slid his torso inside. On his perch high above the others, Dr. Stevenson shifted from one keyboard to the next, pounding his fist on the desktop in frustration. Suddenly his voice took over the PA system.
Initiate procedure to swap primary and secondary stasis field generator controls. Dr. Trotsky, override the con from your position. Now!
As the pulsing alarm blared, Ted stared in horror as the air surrounding the point where the anomaly containment device had previously been suspended acquired a pale blue glow within what he could only imagine was the failing spherical stasis field. A flurry of activity along the near side of the ATAC pulled his eyes away from the glowing sphere. Several people had moved to surround a gray-haired scientist at one of the ATAC workstations who had slumped forward over the controls. Remembering who he was, Ted pulled himself together and pointed.
"Get me a camera on that!"
The video feed shifted, zooming in on the group of scientists gathered behind the workstation. A young woman in a white lab coat pushed her way through, physically lifting the scientist from the chair, handing his unconscious body to two men, then sliding into his chair. The woman's hands moved across multiple keyboards, her actions a blur, backdropped by a bank of flat panel displays. The movements of her lithe body, the way her short spiked platinum blonde hair framed her face, gave Ted a déjà vu moment, reminding him of a hot pop star rising up into the sky above her European concert audience.
Warning! Primary stasis field generator power at 40% and falling. Stasis field failure imminent.
As he continued to watch the exotic young physicist work, Ted heard a low moan of dread rise up from the other scientists, a moan that entered the microphones and drifted out to a network audience of billions. President Jackson stared at the CNN broadcast, surrounded by his national security team. General Smith's tense voice sounded through the encrypted satellite speakerphone.
"Mr. President, we are out of time."
Looking around the room, meeting the eyes of each member of his staff, each head nodding in affirmation, the president swallowed, then spoke with reluctant authority.
"General Smith, I authorize you to immediately implement Anomaly Failsafe Plan Bravo."
"Mr. President, I read back.
General Smith, I authorize you to immediately implement Anomaly Failsafe Plan Bravo."
"Confirmed."
"Roger, Mr. President."
"Smith out."
Raising his eyes once again to the television screen, President Jackson spoke again, his voice barely rising above a whisper.
"God help us all."
General Raymond Smith swiveled his chair and nodded to the only other person in the command and control bunker beneath Ramstein Air Base, just outside Kaiserslautern, Germany, Major Bob Glendale.
"You heard the president's authorization?"
"Yes, sir."
"Open your envelope."
As Bob reached for the envelope on the workstation in front of him, General Smith turned to face front, picked up a knife, and slid open his own brown manila envelope, spilling the contents onto his own workstation. He glanced at the checklist, but he knew it by heart. This wasn't Anomaly Failsafe Plan Alpha. This was Bravo. That meant there would be no warning to the poor bastards inside the Atlas Cavern. The president had just given the Nuke It Now order. Picking up the cylindrical red key with the number one tag dangling from it, the general glanced over at Major Glendale, who had his own key in hand.
"Insert keys."
The major inserted his key in the console as General Smith mirrored his action.
"Activate on my mark."
"Mark." As the keys turned in unison, a bright green LED lit up on the panel in front of General Smith. Flipping up the red trigger guard, General Smith took a single deep breath, pushing from his mind the thought of the innocent soon to die. Then, he thumbed the toggle switch to detonate.
Chapter 120. Watching the imagery from a dozen separate worm fibers, Raoul rubbed his hands in anticipation. Despite the heady stew of arrayed forces that had long been destined for this moment, an alien armada, Dr. Stevenson, three Ultrian ship mutants, and the combined intellectual might of the Earth's best and brightest, only Raoul had put it all together. Here, floating in his own fortress of solitude, he could feel the power bubbling up through his neural net, the awesome force of God's will. Right now, at this singular moment, there was only one archangel, and Raoul was it. Not God's son, as he'd earlier believed, but his mighty right hand. His entire life had been in preparation for this. Raoul had checked and rechecked his preparations. After all, he'd only get one chance at this, and the tolerances were very tight. If he hadn't had complete access to the alien invasion plan right within his starship's archive, what he was going to do would have been impossible. But he had the gateway synchronization codes and the stasis field modulation codes from the original plan. And since Stevenson was intent on bringing the aliens through the gateway, he was going to have to match those codes. The image of Dr. Stevenson calmly strolling through Raoul's stasis field formed in his mind. Yeah, Raoul had enjoyed a front-row seat at a demo of just what someone with knowledge of the stasis field modulation codes could accomplish. He just hoped Stevenson got to try that little number again. It wasn't just Stevenson that was going to get a little surprise. The Kasari Collective had done this thousands of times on worlds across the galaxy. But they hadn't counted on their world ship being shot down on Earth, hadn't anticipated Dr. Stevenson's crazy plan to force world governments to build the gateway by creating a micro-black hole. That's what made the tolerances so tight. Stevenson was counting on a brief delay before he applied the gateway synchronization codes after creating the wormhole, just enough time to use a second stasis field to push the anomaly into deep space before locking down the other end of the gateway. It wouldn't do to have the alien Wehrmacht charge right into a blossoming black hole. Raoul didn't particularly want to be sitting on an X-planet either. That meant he couldn't just sync the Roe ship's own wormhole generation engine with Stevenson's gateway. So he had to let the initial stages of Dr. Stevenson's operation go as planned before he made his play. And so did Heather and the Smythe twins. It was why they had to be on site. Glorious. Back when Raoul had first gained complete access to the rebooted Roe ship's computers and discovered that no living thing could survive a one-ended wormhole transit, he'd wondered why the Kasari hadn't just sent their robotic world ship through and then utilized it to form the far end of the gateway. After all, each ship had its own wormhole generation engines. The problem was that, while the world's ships could generate their own transit wormholes and could even establish a temporary link to a full-sized Kasari gateway, they couldn't produce one of the size and stability capable of transporting a Kasari invasion force and its equipment. And while their population seduction technique didn't always work, the Kasari had never experienced a failure once a gateway had gone active. Until today. As Raoul watched the worm fiber imagery play out in his head, a slow grin crept across his face. His artificial eye firmly locked onto the feed of a black-garbed security guard.
Hello, Heather.
Chapter 121. Weapons specialist Inga Hedstrom cradled the M25 counter-defilade target engagement rifle in the crook of her left arm as she scanned the Atlas cavern. All the guards carried the M25, although they were only allowed to load the same goober non-lethal rounds that had been used to capture Heather and the Smythes in Bolivia. The thinking was that if anyone freaked out on G-Day, they could freeze him in place without running the possibility of damaging critical equipment. But today, she had substituted high-explosive airburst rounds for the goobers. Nodding to her Spanish teammate on the metal walkway 20 feet up and to her left, she let her visions take her. Mark and Jennifer were in the cavern, going about their assigned duties, taking no notice of her. Today they all carried the bandolier ship headsets, wearing them around their necks, hers hidden beneath the black uniform's collar. Just one more precaution among the many they had taken. Heather just hoped they would be enough. The countdown to anomaly capture was progressing normally. Dr. Stevenson, on his perch at the primary command console, high above the rest of the scientists and technicians manning the ATAC workstations around the gateway's base. Approaching final countdown to anomaly capture. The announcement was replaced by the final countdown. Initiating anomaly capture. The anomaly containment device came apart, its parts crashing to the floor less than 50 meters from where she stood. Heather tensed. The culmination of all their planning was seconds away, and just like Mark and Jen, she was ready. The blaring alarm gave way to an even louder PA announcement.
Initiate procedure to swap primary and secondary stasis field generator controls. Dr. Trotsky, override the con from your position. Now!
As Jennifer shoved the unconscious Trotsky aside and took over at the secondary control console, Heather saw Mark rip away the metal panel covering the electronics powering the primary stasis field. Mark had less than a minute to restore power to the primary field generator in order for it to pick up the secondary stasis field generator's initial mission, which was as important as Jennifer's taking control of the anomaly with the secondary stasis field. As she watched the anomaly pulse energy into the containment field, equations cascaded through Heather's mind. The handoff from the primary to the secondary field generator had been expertly handled. But matter had leaked in, sending the anomaly into a death spiral. Until the primary stasis field regained power to seal the portal, Stevenson couldn't activate the wormhole device. If Mark was late by even a few seconds, none of this was going to matter.
Primary stasis field power back online.
A cheer went up from the ATAC,
as Dr. Stevenson shifted at his console.
Immediate wormhole generation commencing.
No time for a countdown. Just enough to create the wormhole and validate the far-end space-time coordinates. Then Jennifer would modulate the secondary stasis field to allow it to pass the anomaly through the primary and out into deep space. Then, Jen would use the secondary field to destroy the gateway before Stevenson could open it up to the invaders. Heather refined her calculations. 5 minutes and 17 seconds until the growing event horizon spilled out of the containment field and swept everyone to his or her ultimate destiny. If everything went according to plan, they should have 2 minutes to spare. If everything went according to plan.
Chapter 122.
Why don't we have detonation?
General Smith's voice over the secure telephone unit carried a tension that Captain Everett could feel like static electricity.
Sir, we've lost comms to the nukes.
Captain, I don't care if you have to manually initiate. I need that detonation. Whatever it takes.
Wilco.
Captain, your country is counting on you.
Captain Everett set the handset back in its cradle, then began running toward the doorway that led to the Atlas Cavern. He was going to die today anyway, but maybe, just maybe, he could pull the plug on the thing that was about to eat his wife, his baby girl, and the whole damn planet.
Far gate active!
The notification entered Commander Keaton Ra's mind through the nanobot communication swarm distributed throughout his brain.
Synchronization.
Not yet initiated from the far end.
Why not?
It appears the wormhole is directed at a point in Galactic Zone 3AF2344XZ.
Keaton Ra hissed.
He'd waited too long to have something go wrong now.
Override from this end. Lock it down, now.
Dangerous.
Do it.
As you command. As power was diverted to the activating gateway, Keaton Ra's detachment came to the ready. When the synchronization reached its final stage, Keaton Ra braced himself as the millions of nanobots throughout his body compensated for the new world's atmosphere, gravity, and pressure differential. The process was straightforward. Start the change as the gateway went final. Charge through the opening as the change progressed. Arrive in the new world, ready to breathe its air and to function in its environment. It always hurt, and this time was no different. Unable to remember the atmosphere he'd been born breathing, Keaton Ra exhaled his final lungful of the ammonia-methane mixture he'd come to regard as normal, and leaped through the portal into a nitrogen-oxygen world.
Chapter 123.
Mark tossed the steel panel onto the floor behind him, flipped onto his back, and pulled his head and shoulders into the electrical access duct. To his neurally enhanced eyesight, the limited ambient lighting seeping into the electrical panel from the cavern was more than adequate. Since he'd rigged the power circuits for the primary and secondary stasis control panels, he knew what he was looking for without need of the normal test and evaluation procedures. Snapping open the cover on the primary control circuit panel, he found the faulty circuit immediately, a bad amplifier module on the main circuit board. Funny. All that power controlled by a tiny transistor. It took only a trickle of current to the transistor to turn on the main power channel. Conversely, the denial of that trickle cut the main power in an instant. Mark had counted on that when he'd installed the module with the faulty resistor, one chosen to build up heat and burn out within a minute of primary stasis control power-up. The pungent odor of burned insulation tickled his nostrils as he grabbed the correct screwdriver from his tool belt and spun the first of 8 screws free, catching each in his palm as it fell, snapping the module free of its mounts. Mark snapped the ribbon cable free and tossed the useless circuit card out onto the floor by his feet. Grabbing his toolkit, he popped open the top, selected the replacement module, and began reinstallation. The kit contained replacements for several of the high-priority circuits, but it didn't hurt that Mark had known exactly which one would blow and when. As badly as they needed the primary stasis control to fail, they needed it back online shortly thereafter. Just enough downtime for Jen to tranquilize Dr. Trotsky and take over operation of the secondary stasis controls. Dr. Stevenson already recognized that she had far more talent than the older man. If not for Russian political pressure, Trotsky's uncle being the president of the Russian Federation, Stevenson would have already replaced Trotsky with the postdoc she impersonated. Snapping the new module in place, Mark tightened the last of the screws and thrust himself out of the compartment and back into the cavern. As he watched, 20 meters away, the portal activated. The effect was instantaneous. One moment the black steel interior was empty. The next, a star field replaced it. The view into space so spectacularly clear that Mark expected to be sucked out into the endless expanse. The fact that he wasn't confirmed not only that the primary stasis field was back online, but also that Dr. Stevenson had used it to seal the gateway. Nothing would be passing through that field without the correct modulation code, and even then, after passing through the film, the object would be subject to the instantaneous changes in pressure, gravity, temperature, and atmosphere that the far side had to offer. All Stevenson needed to do was validate that the space-time coordinates of the far end were far enough from Earth that the anomaly would pose no further threat, a near certainty given the vast expanse available. Then, Jennifer would use the secondary stasis field to thrust the forming black hole through the portal. Immediately after that, she would use the stasis field generator to destroy the gateway. After that, they'd have 15 minutes to get to Jack's rendezvous point. Then, the wormhole shifted.
Chapter 124.
Dr. Donald Stevenson clenched his jaw, lines of concentration burrowing fresh fissures in his forehead. He could be angry later. Right now, he had to fix this giant mess they found themselves in. The almost disastrous handoff of anomaly containment to Dr. Trotsky's station had shocked him. If not for the decisive actions of Trotsky's impressive postdoc, taking over the secondary controls when Trotsky fainted, they'd already be dead. She hadn't wasted a second checking on Trotsky's condition, practically throwing the unconscious man out of his chair as she slid in to replace him. As he finished sealing the portal with the primary stasis field, Dr. Stevenson activated the gateway. A tremor shook the cavern floor, rattling the scaffolding and producing a momentary fluctuation in the power grid. Stevenson adjusted the controls to compensate, allowing the wormhole to come into being at its own pace. A glance at the impedance and temperature measurements for the thick supercooled power cables brought the barest hint of a smile to his lips. Superconductivity was holding, despite the awesome current flowing into his gateway. From his perch, he could see the entire ATAC, had a direct view down into the portal itself. The scientists looked frozen in time, eyes locked on the anomaly trapped within the secondary containment field, the glowing blue orb reminiscent of a giant fortune-teller's crystal ball. In front of Stevenson, beside the computer keyboard, the gateway controls looked like a concert equalizer, an assortment of sliders and knobs that could be adjusted manually or set automatically via the computer. Dr. Stevenson leaned forward and pushed the largest slider all the way to the top. Within the gateway, a star field appeared, wavered, stabilized. As he prepared to validate the coordinates, they changed, an altogether different scene appearing within the portal. What the hell? This wasn't supposed to happen yet. As Donald Stevenson stared at the army assembled in the vaulted chamber on the other end of the gateway, three alien creatures leaped across the threshold. Then the portal shifted again.
Chapter 125.
What the hell? The imagery unfolding in Raoul's sensor array made no sense, momentarily freezing him into inaction. Despite the initial glitches, the gateway had gone active, the far end of the wormhole targeted into empty space. The anomaly should have already been shoved through the portal. Instead, the gateway had somehow synchronized with the Kasari gateway. And, much to his horror, the lead members of the assault cohort leaped through the portal. The first one through, the apparent commander, never hesitated, grabbing the nearest scientist with two of his powerful arms, the third pistoning a jagged blade into the man's torso as the fourth arm pointed toward a nearby security guard. Two spider creatures lunged out of the portal, one of them launching itself toward the black-clad female soldier, the other racing up the scaffolding toward a second black-uniformed military man. As he saw the first of the spiders close on Heather, Raoul snapped out of his brain freeze. Although the timing was all wrong, he couldn't let the Kasari continue to pour into the Atlas cavern. Activating his own wormhole engine, Raoul applied the synchronization codes, locking onto the Atlas gate to seal off the Kasari portal. Raoul adjusted his worm fiber feeds from the Atlas cavern. Where seconds earlier the portal had opened into the Kasari staging area, Raoul's legless body now hung in the air within his row ship's command center. Above the ATAC, a startled exclamation escaped Dr. Stevenson's lips. Raoul ignored him, shifting his attention to the nightmare leaping toward Heather. As it reached her, she blurred into motion, rolling sideways, regaining her feet with a 9mm Glock in her left hand and her heavy rifle cradled in her right. The Glock firing so fast it sounded like an automatic, each slug penetrating her alien opponent's misshapen body as it spun to face her, knocking it backward, but not down. Raoul's neural net supplied him the reason she wasn't firing the larger weapon. It was an M25, the programmable explosive shells designed to engage at distance, each one exploding with the force of a small grenade, allowing its wielder to destroy enemies hiding behind cover, but almost useless at close range since the round didn't arm itself until it had traveled 30 meters downrange. It was still a big bullet at point-blank range, but not one you wanted to waste unless absolutely necessary. Enough of this shit. Time to grab Heather and bring her home before she got herself killed. As he shifted part of his own stasis field to reach through the gateway and pluck her from the madness of the Atlas chamber, his lock on the Atlas gateway destabilized, then resynchronized, this time on the Kasari gateway. Immediately, 9 Kasari warriors spilled into the row ship.
Chapter 126
Dr. Stevenson hesitated, but only for a second. 3 Kasari commandos had entered the cavern, but not the entire assault unit. There should have been at least a dozen to rapidly secure the gateway device. And now gunfire had broken out, as one of the 2 multi-legged Groth killers had failed to instantly terminate the female commando. Worse, the not-so-dead Raoul had somehow diverted the gateway, sinking it to the row ship's wormhole star drive engines. Shifting his attention to the anomaly decay calculations, Stevenson grimaced. If he didn't get control of the gateway in the next minute and a half, everyone involved was about to have a very bad day. A glance down at the secondary stasis field control station gave him a rush of relief. Dr. Nika Ivanovich, the postdoc who'd taken over for Trotsky, remained at her station, maintaining containment of the anomaly and ready to launch it through the gateway if he could get it pointed away from Earth and not at the Kasari staging base. Stevenson had no intention of shoving an emerging black hole up the ass of the collective. Throwing the gateway controller into maintenance override while the wormhole was active was a crazy risk, purging the synchronization codes as it performed a controller reboot. The theoretical effect on the wormhole was indeterminate. It would certainly break Raoul's connection to the gateway, but would also deny the Kasari an immediate reconnection. That meant that the 3 Kasari who had already come through would have to try to gain control in the cavern until reinforcements could arrive. While there was a very heavy NATO, French, and Swiss security presence on site,
Almost all of that force was outside the building. Its mission, to protect the project from any attack from outside the secure perimeter. That meant the small special ops team on duty within the cavern was on its own until the rapid response force could get here. As he initiated the gateway's maintenance override, Stevenson glanced down at the portal. The image of Raoul floating inside the Rose ship winked out, replaced by dancing star fields. Damn it. The uncontrolled wormhole was waggling through space-time like a dog's tail. If it leaped deep into a galactic core before the controls rebooted, the primary stasis field draping the portal couldn't protect them. Still, the odds of survival were in their favor. Big sky, little stars. Ignoring the continuing rattle of gunfire, Dr. Stevenson focused his attention on preparing for the moment the reboot completed, when it would allow him to lock the wormhole to its original coordinates. Thumbing the microphone, he spoke into the PA system. Dr. Ivanovich, prepare for anomaly transport within 20 seconds. Initiate on my mark. 1:57 until the end of the world. And, at the moment, all he could do was sit there and twiddle his thumbs.
Chapter 127. Mark stared into the wormhole device in disbelief. A vast chamber yawned before him, most of its floor space filled with the vanguard of the alien army they were here to stop. Before he had finished digesting this new circumstance, three aliens plunged through the stasis field. The first, a bipedal, four-armed being, standing a full 7 feet tall, leaped onto the first tier of the ATAC, grabbed the nearest scientist from his workstation, and impaled him on a 2-foot jagged blade. As the man opened his mouth to scream, the powerful arm stabbed him again, transforming the sound into a bubbling wail that followed the man into death. Two other creatures skittered across the cavern floor, toward the surrounding scaffolding draping the walls on either side of the ATAC. From Mark's viewpoint, they loped along like 8-legged gorillas, thick bodies the size of sofas, open jowls screeching a keening yowl. If they had eyes, he couldn't see them. Mark started moving, his hands suddenly filled with the heavy hammerhead lineman's pliers from his tool belt, his legs driving him toward the four-armed alien that had just tossed the dead man into the panicked scientist scrambling away from the assault. Mark reached the thing's back as gunfire erupted behind him. Off to his left, the wormhole shifted again. Adrenaline flooding his system, Mark swung the pliers with every ounce of strength he could generate, the force of the blow caving in a section of the thing's skull, sending it crashing into the next row of elevated workstations. It slipped, arms flailing, but somehow regained its balance, whirling to meet its attacker with a wide sweep of its knife hand. Mark threw himself sideways, barely avoiding the weapon's jagged tip. The creature turned to fully face him, rising into a crouch as it assessed its opponent, its head wound repairing itself as Mark watched. The smell of the thing filled his nostrils, an ammonia diesel fuel perfume that made his eyes water. Its orange and black flecked eyes blinked twice, lids closing bottom up. Then it plunged toward him, a second blade filling another of its hands. Mark accepted the charge, dropping to his back as he struck out with both legs, propelling every bit of his power into the quick thrust. Based upon the shock of the impact, he judged the alien's weight to be better than 600 pounds. It didn't matter. The being might be big and able to heal in a way that made Priest Williams look like a sickling, but compared to Mark, it was moving in molasses. The blow landed directly on the groin area, redirecting the alien's charge into a flailing heels-over-head flight over Mark and back out onto the open cavern floor. Whipping his legs around, Mark landed back on his feet before the alien stopped rolling, his breath puffing out of his mouth and nose in twin attempts to clear the stench that threatened his oxygen supply. As blood wept down his face from a fresh scalp wound, Mark hurled the pliers at the rising creature's lower left hand, the tool opening as it spun through the air, its momentum tearing the long blade from its grip and sending it spinning along the floor toward the portal opening. The alien ignored it, moving toward Mark once again, this time in a controlled fighter's crouch instead of a charge, its remaining sword at the ready, its other three hands swaying in a wrestler's pose. Mark turned and ran. Behind him, the alien followed, and although it wasn't nearly as quick, it was fast. Halfway to the scaffolding, Mark turned hard right, then again, allowing his larger opponent's momentum to carry it past him. The maneuver gained him 5 meters. Focusing on achieving all the speed he could generate, Mark let his legs propel him toward the alien's dropped blade. The slap of heavy boots on concrete behind him told him the race was going to be close.
Chapter 128
Raoul's moment of hesitation almost cost him his life. The first alien to spill through the portal into his command center hurled a spinning blade with such force it would have passed all the way through his torso if it had reached him. Instead, it glanced harmlessly off the invisible stasis shield he erected in front of his body. Seeing 8 additional Kasari jump through the portal into the Rose ship, Raoul sealed it behind them. Despite their training, the Kasari assault team wasn't prepared for the legless apparition that hung suspended in the air before them, wielding a stasis field for which they lacked the modulation codes. Neither did they expect his mind to be seamlessly interconnected with their own world ship's neural network. As Raoul looked beyond the 9 members of the trapped Kasari assault team and into the vast expanse of the invasion staging chamber, he knew he didn't have much time. While the assault team offered no threat to him, even the stasis field could not long defend him against the advanced heavy weaponry available to the army in that facility. Its commanders had been stunned into inaction by the gateway's unexpected shift. But, unless he enhanced the impact, their lack of coordinated response wouldn't last long enough. Manipulating his field with long-practiced expertise, he filled the surrounding chamber with a tight grid of microscopic force planes, dicing the 9 Kasari so rapidly even their super nanobots had no chance at compensating. Collapsing the force grid, he packed the orange-green Kasari soup into a ball and shot it back through the portal, where it exploded into the midst of the assembled troops like a giant paintball. Raoul didn't wait to watch it, turning his full attention to the worm fibers inside the Atlas cavern. He couldn't just terminate his end of the gateway. The modifications he'd made to the Rose ship's wormhole drive consumed so much power on initiation it would take weeks to recharge the reserves for another attempt. Disconnecting from the far end would shift his wormhole engines to some random point in space, throwing the starship's drive into its primary mode of operation, transporting it through the wormhole, a trip no one could hope to survive. No, he had to stay linked to a far gateway until he brought the system down in a controlled fashion. That meant that if he wanted to get Heather, he had to stay linked to the Kasari gateway until he could reacquire the one in the Atlas cavern. Stevenson had done something to regain control of his portal, something that Raoul needed to counter, and he needed to make it happen right now.
Chapter 129
Ketan Ra hurtled through the gateway, landing in the dimly lit cavern, accompanied by 2 Groth shock troopers just to his right. His shared nanobot tactical display showed only 2 armed humans, one at floor level, another high up along the metal latticework that draped the walls. He wasn't surprised by the lack of human military at the gateway. Of all the worlds they'd assimilated, most had had no armed presence at the portal. The whole point of building a Kasari-inspired gateway was to welcome the benevolent species that offered a world so much astounding technology. It made no sense to open the gateway and present a threatening presence to one's benefactors. Motioning with an arm, Ketan Ra issued a mental command, sending the 2 Groth scurrying to eliminate the soldiers as he focused on understanding every aspect of his tactical display. Something was wrong with the portal behind him. He didn't need to look to confirm that it had lost the link with the Kasari staging planet. Only he and the two Groth had made it into the cavern. By now, he should have had his entire dozen-member team already moving through the coordinated dance they'd rehearsed hundreds of times. Worse, a bright red rotating threat matrix highlighted something he'd already seen with his own eyes. A glowing orb contained within a stasis field, a handful of strides in front of him. The energy readings showed the field contained an asymptotic gravitational event with a rapidly expanding event horizon. A bomb. As hard as it was to believe what he was seeing, he couldn't deny what the data was telling him. Somehow, this species had rejected the beneficial concept of assimilation and responded by using the Kasari technologies to construct a gravity bomb with a growing singularity at its core. As the scanner displays flashed through his mind, instantly identifying each piece of equipment in the cavern along with its probable purpose, his initial assessment was confirmed. The stasis field containing the singularity was programmed to thrust it through the gateway upon a command from its operator. And if he didn't get control of that station very quickly, the humans might just succeed in destroying a Kasari staging planet, along with multiple gateways and millions of highly trained warriors. A scowl spread across Kitan Ra's face. Not happening. Not through his gateway. Turning to the left, Kitan Ra identified the human female operating the workstation on the third stair-stepped platform that wrapped behind the gateway. With a red numeric countdown in the corner of his sensory display, he leaped onto the first platform and grabbed the human male who had just begun to rise from his seat, impaling him on the dual-edged Kedra, and tossing the body aside as he prepared to leap to the next level. A tactical alert triggered his attention. A human moving up behind him, fast. Very fast. The force of the blow staggered him, caving in the right rear section of his skull as he started to turn toward his attacker. For a matter of seconds, Kitan Ra lost all tactical, while the nanobots swarmed to repair the brain injury. Ignoring the loss of awareness, he whirled toward the human, pulling the second Kedra from his equipment belt and driving his bulk forward with all the power his legs could deliver. As his upper two arms reached to embrace his opponent and pull him into the sweeping blades, the human dropped to his back, his feet catching Kitan Ra in the junction between his legs with surprising force, adding a vertical component to his forward momentum, launching him over his target, one blade barely nicking the human's head. He hit the ground and rolled to his feet as Tactical came back online. Kitan Ra knew he'd failed to compensate for this planet's lower gravity. Compounding that error, the human showed startling dexterity, far greater than anything he'd seen from the world ship's periodic reports on this planet. One of the Groth had taken out a guard, but the other was having its own problems, taking fire from a human female who displayed traits similar to the one he was fighting. The tactical network incorporated this new data, adjusting the team's tactics as they moved. A projectile flew from his opponent's hand so fast that it hit his lower left hand before he could move it out of its path, breaking the bone just below his wrist and sending the Kedra skidding across the floor toward the portal. Again, his tactical display shifted dramatically, showing a gateway connection to another point on this planet, a connection to the Kasari's own worldship. Shrugging off this distraction, he prepared himself for the human male's charge. It never came. As Kitan Ra's wrist knitted itself back together, the human broke into panicked retreat. With his legs providing more controlled explosions, Kitan Ra gave chase, smiling at the cascading displays in his head. The chase wasn't going to be a long one. The human cut to the right, and once again, the absence of sufficient gravity betrayed Kitan Ra, robbing him of the friction necessary to match the human's two tight turns. At least now the other's plan was clear. Get to the dropped Kedra. He planned to stop and fight. Kitanra relaxed, letting his pace slow just enough to make sure the human got there first. It was the kind of fight he wanted. Kedra to Kedra. His four hands and superior strength and healing against this human's quickness. A truly worthy opponent. Mark's finger closed around the alien sword's haft, feeling the grip adapt to his hand. As he whirled to face his pursuer, he measured the weapon's weight and balance, his eyes caressing the black sword's 3-foot blade. Two razor-sharp edges swept to a Roman point, practically screaming for blood. He liked it. The big alien came to a controlled stop 3 paces from where Mark waited, its own sword gripped in its lower right fist, the other 3 arms reaching toward him like a wrestler's, like a couple of wrestlers. So it had learned Mark's momentum tricks. No more bull rushes. Just good old-fashioned man versus giant 4-armed alien combat. A mental image from the classic B-movie Clash of the Titans brought a grin to his face. Amazing. The alien warrior appeared to be waiting for him to make the first move. As Mark raised the sword in front of him, another thought filled his mind. Hail Caesar. We who are about to die salute you. Then Mark's body blurred into motion. Chapter 130 Heather tossed the M25 rifle up onto the 3rd level of scaffolding, swinging herself up along the rifle's arc, ejecting 1 magazine and slapping another into the Glock as she landed. 15 feet below, the ugly beastie righted itself from the impact of 15 9-millimeter parabellums, the holes in its body healing as it moved to follow her. With visions filling Heather's mind, rearranging themselves as she and the alien creature danced their deadly waltz, she emptied the fresh magazine into the gorilla spider, each round striking a different body part as she sought lethality data. The bullets tore the alien from its hold on the railing, sending it sprawling onto the floor below. And once again, Heather grabbed the M25 and tossed it to a higher level, following it up along the metal latticework with all the speed her body and training could provide. Her vision shifted, and Heather leaped to her left as a long blade flashed through the space she'd just occupied, clanged off the wall and rattled down through the space between the steel walkways. Then, with a thin, mewling squall, the alien propelled itself up after her. Click, clack. Another magazine replaced its predecessor. Once more, the Glock spewed its lead saliva into her pursuer, this time targeting the small bulbous knobs Heather believed to be the thing's sensory organs. And although it continued its upward climb, it failed to follow her as she picked up the M25 and ran east along the north wall. Realizing it had lost her, the creature paused, allowing the nanobot healing process to restore its sensory array. It didn't take long, a mere 8 seconds. But as it reacquired her, Heather finished lasing her target. The projectile armed itself at 30 meters, tore into its target at 32, and exploded with the force of a grenade. The groth became a fine green-yellow mist, out of which writhing gelatinous blobs and twitching limbs whipped into the cavern below. Before her exultant yell could make it from her lungs to her lips, one of Heather's visions stifled it in her throat. Leaning out over the railing, she looked up. Less than 10 meters up and to the right, a 2nd gorilla spider raced down the steel latticework toward her. Heather spun left, running along the metal grating, her black boots making the flooring sing as she approached the near corner. Behind her, she felt the gorilla spider land on the walkway, the sound painting a clear image of its powerful 8-legged lope quickly closing the space between them. The quick look she'd just gotten of this one had been enough. Unlike the 4-armed alien fighting Mark on the cavern floor, the spider thing carried no weapons. Each of its 8 legs ended in a hairy hand, each finger sporting raptor-like retractable claws. From the goo, blood, and intestinal splatter that covered its bulbous body, It must have torn apart her partner after wading through the goober munitions web. And if it got its hands on her, the result would be no different. With each stride, Heather watched 100 scenarios play out in her mind. Cradling the short rifle in the crook of her right arm, she hit the end of the walkway, spun, and pulled the trigger. The explosive round had no time to arm, hammering into the alien body after traveling only 3.872 meters. And although it didn't explode, the impact lifted the black, hairy body, sending it rolling back along the walkway, as if it had stepped in front of a speeding truck. Since she hadn't been braced, the recoil flung Heather backward, her left hand just catching the rail as she tumbled backward over it, her beret spinning like a small black frisbee. Seeing the spider thing right itself, Heather kicked outward, released her grip on the rail, and dropped the 22 feet to the concrete floor, transferring momentum into a forward roll as she landed. As she came back to her feet, she squeezed off another round into the alien as it scurried down the steel lattice after her. No time to laze the target or thumb in extra distance. It didn't matter. She hadn't gained the required arming distance, and her mind told her the alien had figured it out. As the 25-millimeter round knocked the alien from the scaffolding, Heather ran toward the cage, a massive rack support structure that housed all the heavy cables that carried power from the matter disruptor facility to the wormhole device and stasis field generators. The workmen who had built it, Mark included, all hated it with a passion that bespoke the claustrophobia the cage generated in those who had experienced its interior. As big as the thickly insulated cables were, most of the room was taken up with the pipes and cooling equipment required to keep them superconductive. Like everything else on this project, it had been designed with speed of construction and efficiency of operation in mind. Only enough crawl space had been left to allow workmen to wriggle along twisting paths and up narrow ladders. Mark had said there weren't many places inside the cage where he didn't have surfaces pressed against both his front and backsides. And while that might have been an exaggeration, it wasn't much of one. Add that to the wind that howled through these passageways from the powerful fans designed to clear the heat from the cooling machines, and you add something Dante would have loved to include in his description of the lower pits of hell. Pulling the cage schematics to the front of her memory, Heather calculated how long it would take for her to make the GF2 access door, the closest to her position. Overlaying time-sequenced imagery of her and her opponent's anticipated intercept paths, she managed to pull just a bit more speed from her adrenaline-fueled legs. She would beat Spidey to the cage, but getting the door open and getting inside before the alien ripped her apart was going to be close. Her pursuer was adapting to each new 25-millimeter impact, having compensated for the last hit in half the time the first recovery had taken. Without the explosive force provided by a fully armed round, another slug into its body wasn't going to do it. And having lost the Glock and her extra magazines in the fall over the railing, she was down to 3 rounds remaining in the M25 6-round mag. She hit the steel gate with a downward swipe and pulled at the lever handle, sliding through and closing it behind her as the alien's bulk hit it, denting the metal frame inward and jamming the door latch. Heather turned sideways, sliding along the access way until she reached the first junction. Squeezing into the passage on her right, she heard the squeal of tearing metal as the alien ripped the gate from its hinges and flung it into the cavern. At the first ladder, she began climbing. A glance through a narrow gap between equipment and cables showed the alien squeeze into the narrow space, bones flexing and dislocating like a giant hamster's as it adapted to this new environment. Heather climbed faster. 20 meters up, she shifted her body off the ladder and into an even tighter crawl space that forced her to lie on her back and wriggle her body forward along a shaft that scraped her back and sides. She knew what she was headed for, and although the alien had shown the capability to rapidly adapt, it was still quadruple her bulk, and the cage would extract a price for that bulk. Because the crawlways and chimneys between equipment were so tight that tool belts and hand-carried toolboxes were impractical,
Electrical tool cases had been bolted to the racks at strategic points throughout the cage, providing engineers and technicians with an extensive set of test and repair equipment within 10 meters of any point. Squeezing through a space not meant for passage, Heather took advantage of her small form to take a significant shortcut to one of these tool cases. Popping open the latch, she found what she wanted. Ejecting the M25 rifle's magazine from the buttstock, she popped one of the high-explosive airburst rounds into her hand and set to work on it. Carefully cracking open the lower portion of the case, she gained access to the safe and arm circuit. Working with all the speed and dexterity her bandolier-ship neural enhancements and Jack's training had provided her, she made a simple logic circuit modification, bypassing the 30-meter safety mechanism, setting the round to arm immediately upon firing. A guttural roar of frustration 3 meters to her left alerted her to the alien's arrival at the point where she'd squeezed between equipment racks. Good. So there were limits to how much the creature could contort its body. It would have to find its way around, and unless it had a complete schematic of the cage, as she did, that would take a while. As she worked to put the round back together, Heather's mind tracked the alien's progress. Not good. If it didn't have the complete cage schematic, it had a damn good approximation. Rushing through her final task, Heather placed the modified round topmost in the magazine. Slapping it home, she chambered the new round, ejecting its predecessor from the right ejection port. The ejected round clipped the railing and spun away, the cling-clang of its passage sounding all the way down to the cage floor, 67 feet below. Heather reached a new ladder and began climbing once again, the knowledge that she was now down to 2 rounds tugging at her mind. She shrugged it off. If the modified round didn't do the job, whether or not she had 1 or 2 additional shots wouldn't make a bit of difference.
Chapter 131
Dr. Ivanovich, prepare for anomaly transport within 20 seconds. Initiate on my mark.
Dr. Stevenson's voice nudged Jennifer into action. The data on the 6 flat panel displays that wrapped halfway around her swivel chair felt like a demon reaching out to grab her by the throat, 9-inch nails penetrating into her windpipe, shutting off both blood and oxygen flows to her brain. As fast as Stevenson had been in transferring stasis field control to her workstation, he'd taken longer than they'd projected. That delay funneling in extra feed matter to the anomaly, a creature that existed and changed on a femtosecond scale. In a second, light could race almost 7.5 times around the Earth. In a nanosecond, light traveled almost 1 foot. In a femtosecond, light barely got past 1/100,000th of an inch. Roughly 3 times the diameter of a human hair. In a femtosecond, you could die before the electrochemical impulse traveled from one synapse to the next. All things considered, not a bad way to go. If you were dead set on dying. The anomaly was on a decaying spiral with an acceleration curve that scared the shit out of Jennifer. And although they had very little time left, Mark and the alien were locked in a battle directly in front of the gateway, and as long as her brother was between the anomaly and the gateway, there was no way Jennifer was going to thrust the anomaly containment field through that portal. If only the anomaly had been a bit more stable, she could have funneled off a little of the containment field and used it to pluck Mark out of the way before jamming the anomaly through the opening. But it was all she could do, using every bit of the energy available to the stasis field generator, to keep the micro black hole from becoming an instant big one. Diverting just a touch of her concentration, Jennifer contacted Mark. "Can't hold it much longer. Get the hell out of the way."
Chapter 132
Operating in a maze of intertwined futures, Heather slithered through the tangle of pipes, cables, and machinery, steadily working her way up toward that point 90 meters above the Atlas cavern floor where the cage touched the ceiling, up on the skywalk that ran from the cage's highest gate to the cavern exit. That's where she wanted to be, but she wasn't going to make it. Behind her, The gorilla spider continued to adapt to the tight spaces, and as it did, its speed increased. Heather reached a turn and threw her body into the crawl space to her right, feeling a puff of air on her cheek as one of the clawed hands sliced the air where she had just been. The alien body hit the turn, all eight legs propelling it after her. From this angle, Heather could see a toothy maw along the thing's underside. She assumed the horrible smell came from this orifice, although it wasn't helped by the human blood and excrement that still dripped from its body. Grabbing a cable above her head, Heather swung herself up like a gymnast, twisting her body to miss protruding steel cable supports. The maneuver gained her 3 feet. The decision point was rapidly approaching. The moment she would be forced to fire the 25-millimeter high-explosive round, danger close. And when she did, she wasn't the only thing likely to suffer collateral damage. The supercooling system for the primary stasis field wrapped all the power cables in this section of the cage, and that equipment wasn't exactly designed to withstand explosives. As she scrambled hand over hand up a 2-inch vertical pipe, she looked up. Another 25 feet, and she'd reached the ramp that would dump her onto the skywalk. The claw speared her left calf, tearing an 1-inch-deep gash in the muscle and almost tearing her loose from the pipe. Heather scissored her legs, the kick breaking the alien hand and ripping the claw free, sending the creature tumbling 6 feet down the shaft before it caught itself. Heather focused on her leg, shunting away the pain and using her fine muscle control to constrict the torn veins, reducing the wound's blood flow to a trickle. But she was out of time. She would make her final stand right here and now, swinging herself behind a metal panel. She swung the M25 back into the shaft, visualized the bullet trajectory, and pulled the trigger. The concussive blast penetrated the thin steel plates, coating her body in alien slime as it lifted her from her perch and flung her against the outer railing, sending a tidal wave of pain through her right shoulder. Fighting to stay conscious, Heather saw that a foot-long sheet metal shard had speared her just below the right collarbone, a third of its length extending out her back. Her other symptoms pointed to severe concussion. Struggling to a sitting position, she braced herself against the railing that had prevented her from falling 250 feet to the cavern floor below. Shit. When does this get fun? Then, a new alarm klaxon sounded, accompanied by a digitized voice over the PA system. Warning. Primary stasis field cooling system malfunction. Primary stasis field power failure imminent. As a new vision filled her mind, Heather wrapped her good arm and leg around the support strut. Then, with a hurricane squall, the primary stasis field died, opening the portal to the vacuum of empty space.
Chapter 133.
Mark was one with the dance. Once, he'd thought he was meant for basketball, but he'd been born for this. Adrenaline coursed through his system unchecked, fueling his attack. Dodging the alien's counterstroke, his black sword swept an arc that removed the alien's top left arm at the elbow, sending the clutching hand to the concrete floor between them. The alien ignored the loss of a hand, lunging forward onto Mark's blade, its momentum aiding Mark in driving the full length through its thick torso. Only as one of its hands closed around his right wrist, preventing him from pulling the sword free, did Mark realize his mistake. Twisting to the left, Mark grabbed the alien's sword arm with his left hand as the remaining alien hand grabbed his throat and squeezed. With electric sparks arcing across his dimming vision, Jennifer touched his mind.
"Can't hold it much longer. Get the hell out of the way."
Bracing his arms like a gymnast performing the Iron Cross, Mark brought both knees up to his chest, leaned back, and hammered his heels into the alien's face, breaking what would have passed for a nose and rocking its head back. As the alien hammered at his ribs with its amputated stump, Mark scissored his legs around the thing's head, locked his heels,
and squeezed. Feeling the alien grip on his throat loosen slightly, Mark twisted his head to the side and bit into the alien fist, feeling bones snap between his teeth as the acrid alien blood filled his mouth, stinging his lips and gums. The alien's grip on his throat loosened another notch, and Mark felt the blood flow return to his brain. Sucking in rattling breath, he increased the pressure his legs were applying to the alien's head and neck. He didn't have a lot of faith he could crush that skull or break its neck, but he could damn sure try. In the meantime, he began flexing his pinned right wrist, making short sawing motions with the sword blade within the alien's torso. Adopting Mark's tactic, the alien twisted its head and sank its teeth into the flesh of his thigh. Shrugging its shoulders up, it shoved hard with its three good arms, breaking Mark's grip and sending him tumbling across the cavern floor. Ignoring the pain shooting through his leg, Mark rolled to his feet, prepared to meet the charge that didn't come. It didn't take a lot of imagination to figure out why. Watching the alien's fist and injured stomach knit themselves back together, he knew this was a battle of attrition.